You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Oh, that's very nice and very generous. I'm hoping to only speak for like 35 minutes or so and then move to a seminar because, as always, the best conversations happen after the person stepped away from the microphone, right? So I want to be involved in some of those. So seminar style, hopefully, today. Okay, I'm Sally Mann. I'm working class, which of course means I know the difference between going out and going out. I'm working class, which of course means I stand there looking bemused when you invite me to a party. And what it really means is polite conversation over a drink. I'm working class. If you tell me to bring food, I'm going to buy half a cow, cook all day, chuck it in a cooler, turn up and stand there looking at your mean little dish of olives and thinking, I called that one wrong. I'm working class. Of course, I'm incapable of conceptual thought. I'm working class. Of course, I can't delay gratification. Of course, I'm working class, so I believe I'm here on the stage to fulfil some kind of inclusion agenda. I'm working class. Of course, I'm going to use self-deprecating humour rather than the strength of an articulate argument. Thanks for having me. I'm Sally and I'm working class. Or am I? I am the fourth of six generations of my family to live in the same four streets of a particular part of East London called East Ham. I'm now the minister of the church where my great-grandmother met a missionary who adopted the fourth of her 16 children in an East End slum and so changed the course of my family's history. From that point on, every woman in my family has served as part of that same church that now I'm the minister of. I'm a white East Ender, a proud Cockney. Does anyone need subtitles? I can slow down if you need me to. A rarity, really, now. My extended family is a group of Remainers. There are seven households of my immediate family living on the same block in East Ham. We're exceptionally unimaginative people. I'm an oddity. I'm a Remainer. My God is more than a little territorial. I don't even bother to pray when I leave East Ham, because I'm utterly convinced that I've left God behind there. I'm a kind of manifestation of what Ched Myers said at Greenbelt when I was here last many years ago. Hope is where your arse is. Anybody hear him say that? Well, my arse is in East Ham, as is my heart, as is a ridiculous amount of my soul. I'm head over heels in love with my community. I love the people. I love the physical land. I'm a missional specimen, a long-term Remainer. Just chatting with you. Somebody told me 30-odd years in their own community. You're kind of new. I've been in mine for 54. David Benjamin Blower from Nomad visited me to interview me in our community. And he left saying, Sally, your family are like the benevolent mafia. And I just thought, yeah, I want that on my CV. Because, yes, it's true, my mum is the Queen of East Ham. I'm introduced as Ellen's daughter, and that's the highest praise I'll ever get in my community. I'm working class. Is class an identity? Is it my identity? Did I trade it in when I got my PhD in philosophy? Is it a concept? I measured you against that one about working class not doing conceptual thought. You all laughed. I hope it was ironic. If you want to test me about working class people not being able to delay gratification, come on, bring me a donut. We'll test it out here and now. We'll see how long I last. I certainly felt working class when, as part of my postgrad study, I was actually paid for by an Oxford college. That was a turn up for the books, wasn't it? And I had to go and give a seminar, a paper to this Oxford college. And just like all working class people, I kind of hate the meet and greet bit where I don't know anybody. So I got there early, big mistake, stood in the doorway, you know, trying to catch some friendly eye. I was the only woman in the room. I was certainly the only working class woman in the room. And one person came up, and actually sometimes they're on kind of speaking platforms, but they're not here this week, and walked up to me and said, "Oh, excuse me, can you tell me where the bathroom is?" The assumption being, if you're working class and a woman, you're there as some kind of hired help. But what really upset me was I was more embarrassed when I got up to give my paper on Rana's philosophy of language and tried not to catch the man's eye. I certainly felt working class at Oxford. Is class an experience of marginalisation? Well, I'm a sociologist by trade now. Is it a trade? We'll have to ask Luke Lana. I know he's like the only working class Christian in the Anglican Church, isn't it? I've never been a bricklayer, but I am a sociologist. So I'm very aware that in sociology, class is all about performativity now. It's about consumption. It's about habitus. It's a language code. It's knowing how to dress when you go out. It's the ironic Greg's T-shirt bought from Primark. It's the Mockney accent that you put on at St. Martin's when you're studying fine art. But Pulp got there before me. Do you know the lyrics? Oh, rent a flat above a shop, cut your hair and get a job, smoke some fags and play some pool, pretend you never went to school. But you'll never get it right, because when you're laid at bed at night watching roaches climb the wall, if you called your dad, he could stop it all. There you go. Sorry, you know, common people. Class, it's identity, it's exclusion, it's prejudice, it's labelling, nostalgia, consumption, all of those things, but not principally those things. Class is a justice issue. Recently, I've been schooled by a gorgeously angry Welsh sociologist called Guy Standing on class, and by the particular geography of northern Palestine, and that's what I want to share with you this morning. Back in 2011, Guy Standing introduced me to a word which just was so right. The absolute rightness and relevance of it has helped me kind of navigate what it means to be working class in post-industrial, high consumption, high capitalist Britain today. And the word is precariat. I feel like I'm taking you into my first year sociology lecture here. Precariat. Guy Standing coined the term back in 2011, and he said the precariat have replaced the working class. Today's workers have got worse labour conditions than the post-war working class generation. They're the precarious proletariat, the precariat. 18% of the British population, about 20 million people, are in the new working class, the precariat class, where high levels of insecurity define their lives, low economic, cultural and social capital, careerless jobs, no status. Many of them work in the gig economy. The person delivering your Uber Eats is precariat. But the professional classes are becoming members of the precariat. The agency worker who's looking after your kids, the person in charge of prisons, the person giving a lecture who's a visiting lecturer contract, they're all precariat. They're employed as and when they're needed, but no one's paying into their pension or giving them parental leave. The precariat are the fastest growing class in Britain. Flexible work market is the innocuous way to describe what's happening to the working class in Britain today. It means flexible for the people employing you. It means you're carrying the risks of the market economy, laid off when demand drops. But not so flexible if you can't ever schedule a social date because you've no idea if you'll be working or not. The precariat class are on the rise, and the working class are losing many of the benefits that were won in the post-war generation. But it's a good time to be a chief exec in Britain. The flexible labour market has resulted in chief exec wage rising exponentially. Do you know they bounced back within 1 year from pre-pandemic levels of pay? Today, the average chief exec to average worker is 1 to 120 times. Thank you for the... Ooh. Yeah, the average wage is 3.6 million. if you're a chief exec in Britain today. Meanwhile, 47% of families on housing benefit in the private rented sector are in-work families. UK's private landlords received 9.3 billion of housing benefits payment, more than twice what it was a decade ago. So while we might blame the poor, my neighbours in East Ham, for the high rates of welfare budgets, it's actually those who pay low wages and charge high rents who are driving up the welfare budget. Excellent. Always preaching to the choir at Greenbelt. Guy Standing said, Polonier described the first transformation of work in 1944, but there's a second great transformation happening today. The end of state welfare capitalism, the rise of a new class in Britain. This is life in my borough of Newham. 47% of the jobs in Newham are poverty rate jobs. In Newham, we've got the second highest rate of low paid work in London. 33.8% of jobs in Newham pay less than the real living wage. And today, 6 out of 10 households experiencing poverty have at least one person employed. Precariat, a mishmash of temporary zero-hour contracts leading to loan sharks. The kinds of Victorian pool shops that my grandparents would have known. East Ham, through and through, where low wages are exacerbating by high rents. It will cost you £1,800 a month to have a two-bed flat in East Ham, one of the cheapest places in London. God knows what it feels like to live with that kind of precarity. Low, unstable pay, careerless jobs, high rents, precarious shelter. God knows what it feels like. Actually, God does know what it feels like, because one of the mysteries of the incarnation is that not only God as gig economy worker, but God is a gig economy worker in Jesus, because Jesus is from Nazareth and not from Sepphoris. I don't think it's a huge leap of imagination to say that Jesus of Nazareth can relate to the precariat of East Ham. You know, the original biblical words for the job that Jesus had was peasant artisan. We translate that as carpenter, but carpenter to me is like, you know, sitting in a field whittling spoons or something. But the peasant artisan class of Jesus's day were looked down on and pitied because it meant that their family had lost their land rights at some point, and now they had to sell their labour. And Jesus of Nazareth, a village on a hill with potentially only 400 people living in. Jesus of Nazareth as a working man would not have had enough trade in his village of Nazareth to have kept himself together. So it's not a stretch of the imagination to see Jesus spending the majority of his life working 6 days a week, walking down the hill from Nazareth to Sepphoris, the capital city of Galilee, just 3 miles away and visible from the village where he lived. A 3 mile walk downhill to work in Sepphoris and then walking back home at the end of the day. That's how Jesus spent the majority of his life, by the way. Sepphoris, interestingly, you've probably never heard of. But it's a bit like saying you've all heard of East Ham and nobody knows where London is. Or you've all heard of Winston Green, but you don't know where Birmingham is. Isn't it lovely that in the canarchy of God, we know about Nazareth, a place of 400 people, and you've never heard of Sepphoris? That gives me hope that I'm living in exactly the right place. Sepphoris had money compared to Nazareth. It had private villas. The aqueducts from Nazarene hills would come down and fill these private bathhouses. Sepphoris had an armory. Sepphoris had paved roads. But Jesus wasn't from Cetharis. He was from Nazareth. You know, during Jesus' childhood, there was an uprising in Cetharis. They sacked the armory. And so the Romans razed to the ground many of the buildings of Cetharis. And Jesus, as a jobbing carpenter, would have made most of his money rebuilding those villas, which he could not afford to live in. Walking down the hills, noticing the aqueducts, taking the resources from the poor to the rich. It reminds me of getting on the tube in East Ham Station and watching the gig economy workers, the cleaners, the carers, going in on the district line to keep the City of London wealthy, never really benefiting from the enormous wealth that they generate. God is a gig economy worker. God knows about class inequality. Jesus lived it. In Jesus' day, the mass oppression of workers was compounded, of course, by the empire and by religious authorities that put heavy yokes on the backs of ordinary people. Not much has changed, right? And class inequality in Jesus' day fomented social unrest. And it still does today. Guy Standing's book, Precariat, is entitled The Dangerous New Class. I feel like I'm doing like a kind of, you're going to go out and buy the Precariat book, aren't you now? Yeah, you can get the YouTube lectures online for free, by the way. And Guy Standing predicted three things with the rise of the precariat. And they're called dangerous because precarity is not just dangerous to an individual's life. It's enormously dangerous to social fabric. Standing predicted in 2011 the rise of populist far-right politics in Britain because of the change in labour contracts. And he's right. We're seeing it. We're living through it. He also predicted the rise of social unrest, of riots and disorder. The third prediction is the more hopeful one. He said precarity in Britain will give rise to new grassroots organisations for social change. And I wonder if those of us in faith communities are actually part of enfleshing the hope for new organisations for Jesus and justice. We should, shouldn't we? Because the gospel includes or perhaps even focuses on economic redistribution as part of salvation. I mean, when Jesus got up and shared his manifesto at his first and not so successful appearance at a Nazarene synagogue, he riffed off of Isaiah's vision and said he was there to announce a year of Jubilee. Well, Jubilee means land rights are restored. Jubilee means debts are cancelled. That's a very political statement to make. How can you read Mary's Magnificat and not hear economic redistribution? Isn't that what it means to fill the bellies of the hungry and send the full away? A messianic reversal. Yeah, the kanarchy of God, the rule of God's love. We don't like the word kingdom. We're not that Anglican, are we? We're Baptists. The kanarchy of God promises a different economy. Because class inequality is a justice issue. But is it a Jesus and justice issue? I'm here on behalf of Red Letter Christians today. We just curated a book of 25 stories of radical discipleship in communities across Britain. Fantastic book and encouraging stories. And one of the chapters was called Can We Tax Our Way to Justice? Written by a friend and colleague, Simon Jones. And yes, and amen, we can. You see, back in the late 60s, the inequality index between Sweden and Britain was the same, the Gini coefficient. But since the late 60s, Sweden has continued to halve that inequality gap, to shorten and fatten the ladder of hierarchy within their society. And we have gone the other way and copied American capitalism and built this tall, elongated ladder in Britain, with a few at the elite, the chief execs, exponentially earning more than they ever did. And in the meantime, the new class of poor, the working class, the precariat, growing at the bottom. But tax and redistribution of wealth could bring us back to a Gini coefficient more like Sweden's within 10 years. We could do it. Of course, we don't want to do it, because those who have amassed the wealth of Britain in the last 50, 60 years don't teach us about the basic economic processes which would reverse it. So there's two ways I want to land, and we are going to do a more interactive part very soon. Did you all get some dots? Have everyone been given some dots? Yeah. Johnny, you got any more dots? Loads more. If you put your hand up, Johnny can bring you some dots so you can take part in a minute. I want to land it in two ways. The first way is, what can faith communities do to express Jesus and justice in terms of economic inequality, following Jesus of Nazareth, the God who is gig economy worker? So I've only ever been to one church in my whole life, the church where my great-grandmother was, the church where my grandmother was, where the Queen of East Ham, Ellen, is, the church where my kids are part of a church plant, and even my grandkids come. So I can only speak about what we've been doing in our church community. It's called Bonnie Downs. It is actually the promised land. Bonnie Downs. Really odd. You're kind of thinking like grassy field, but it's in the middle of the East End of London. Well, 25 years ago, we planted a charity from our church called Bonnie Downs Community Association. We've put up a few little kind of posters so you can keep in touch with us and follow us if you want. We've got an online model of church as well as in person. That charity 25 years ago was set up entirely with volunteers from the church, partnering with people of goodwill in the community. Today, BDCA, our charity, employs 100 local people, and they're all paid the living wage. It's possible, with a church of few resources in a place of great need, to manifest the canarchy of God. Another way we try to do this is within our own church, which sits alongside and part of the charity. We model non-hierarchical leadership. So in Bonnie Downs, I'm one of five ministers. We all share one wage. We're all co-vocational, which means, unlike your minister, we've all got proper jobs. Three of the five of us are women. Yep. Three of the five of us are Indigenous East Enders. These are like Venn diagrams, you know, you can figure out who's who after a while. There's other kinds of inclusion there. One of them is a gay woman married to another member of our leadership team. Yeah, I need a T-shirt that says "not that kind of Baptist," right? And we model this not just for the pragmatic reason that our church needs far more than the leadership skills and giftings of any one person, but because we believe that it better reflects that we need to use what's strong in communities to fix what's wrong, and not constantly hear that Custom House, Governor B, bless him, I love him, but if you'd have heard him speak about Custom House, you'd have never even gone through it, let alone raise your three kids there, as we did, and our grandchildren. It's a brilliant place with so much that's strong in terms of community and resourcefulness. So our charity employs locally, models the living wage. Our church flattens hierarchies of power, distributes leadership. And now we're getting to the exciting bit. We're going to rebuild our church site. Now, it's not exactly a heritage building. The original building is a 1930s asbestos hut. So nobody's going to be too worried when we take it down. But we're not going to rebuild it primarily as a worship sanctuary. We're going to rebuild it as a co-living experiment. The ground floor of our building will be home for our day centre for homeless people, which currently works out of a pavilion. And then there are going to be 8 little flats for people who've experienced homelessness and trauma. And then there will be 2 missional flats for people to live in, to lead daily offices of not just prayer, although we do that in our community at 8 every day, and you can join us online if you'd like to, contemplative prayer at the start of the day, but also the practices of working together, because we've got a community garden and we grow food together and we raise chickens together. We had 8, we killed the lot. So hopefully, hopefully we're going to be better at human flourishing than chicken flourishing. But we want to model a way of life, which is countercultural, but beautifully fitting to the Sermon on the Mount that Jesus preached. Got a story to tell you. We've taken a while to get planning permission for our church rebuild. It's going to be called Bonnie Downs Abbey. Yeah. We love the idea of using lots of sacred spaces and shared life. And so it will have like a shared life for the people living in the 10 households, but it will also be a kind of community, a living room for the whole of our scattered community at East Ham and anyone that needs a meal, because there'll be a community meal every single day. So there'd been this kind of gap between our original financial model and actually getting planning permission. And we sat down with the team. We're working with J49, brilliant Christian partnerships in rebuilding. And when we looked at it, we realised that even with our grant applications being successful, we were £500,000 short of actually being able to do it. So we're resourceful people. We said, you know what we need? We need a super donor. We need somebody to give us, without strings attached, £500,000. And then we can have these 2 flats that we don't have to raise rent from, for people living in, being willing to kind of, you know, facilitate spiritual community. A super donor is what we need. So we went to bed. I got up in the morning. And my husband of 36 years, I always introduce us as being happily married for 30 years. My husband of 36 years bought me a cup of tea, which is not uncommon, but then said to me something incredibly uncommon. Sally, I found the super donor. And I just thought, amen, brother. He's so good at networking, Dave. He knows everybody. And I thought, yeah, he's remembered some secret millionaire, you know, or some trust or somebody that wants to invest in the East End of London. I was like, who is it? And he said, do you know who it is, babe? It's us. Because our church doesn't have a manse, so we own our home, bang opposite where we're going to rebuild the Urban Abbey. And he said, do you know what? Let's sell up. Let's give the lot and let's move in. 36 years ago, someone should have told me who I was marrying. I mean, I knew when I met him that the way he lived meant I would never be financially wealthy. I just knew that by the car he was driving at the time. And he's consistently given away our money, so much so I have to hide it from him. But the good news was, I met a disciple of Jesus who, when he read the Sermon on the Mount, said, what if Jesus meant it? What if Jesus meant what he said in the Sermon on the Mount? What would the church community look like if we didn't really go too far past the Sermon on the Mount? I mean, can you imagine following Jesus for 3 years, hearing the Sermon on the Mount and thinking, do you know what our big issue is in the church today? The gender of people who get married. Like, let's inspect genitals. That's the really Christian thing to do. Come on. So I probably should have had a health warning when, as a child bride, I married Dave 36 years ago. But Red Letter Christianity is about attempts to live out the Sermon on the Mount. So Dave said, Jesus almost said, Dave said, now he knows that that's not Freudian. Dave said, baby sus, we are the mega donors. Let's sell it. And we are. We're doing it. So in December, our building's coming down. And in 14 months' time, we'll be fully invested in the dream that God has given us at Bonnie Downs. Our community also tries to address structural inequalities with food clubs and debt advice. We've got a massive project for people who have no recourse to public funds. We run an enormous day centre for people experiencing homelessness and a social enterprise in gardening, which is Johnny sitting down the front here, so that people can work through trauma by growing food together. Don't really let Johnny cook, but the food growing is great. And in my community, we really do know how to party. We have the best parties. And we really dance and we dress up to go out. And we all bring enormous amounts of food because there's nowhere like the East End of London for the Kanaki of God. So if our story is kind of like a mustard seed of yours, or maybe yours already there and you're in front of us, please do stay in touch. We'd love you to come and visit. We'd love you to hang out with us. We've got some posters up to tell you how to keep in touch. So I do believe that the local, the congregational, can be a massive part of manifesting Jesus and justice. There's 25 further stories of radical discipleship in the book, Jesus and Justice. The Abbey story didn't even make it in. That's how good the book is. But there's also a role to play for political organisation. I can't read Mark's gospel and not hear a kind of political alternative to empire. And a key role of Red Letter Christians is to amplify the voices of organisations that are really doing this. And so I thought what we could do really now is look at some policy change that would actually address the structural inequality faced by the working people in Britain, would successfully redistribute income. And so the majority of them are from Tax Justice. And I've got a kind of little seminar table over there. And I wondered if, as part of our response and the time that we've got left, you might want to go ahead and have a look at some of the policy changes that could work. And you've got 10 dots, because this is how we make decisions in my community. At our members' meetings, you get 10 dots at the start. And to make a decision, we put out some options and then you vote with your 10 dots. You can put all 10 dots on one proposal because you believe that's the key thing to be doing. Or you can split your dots up among the 7 or 8 proposals. But there's also some blank paper there as well, because perhaps the wisdom for how to end the structural inequality in our society lies with you. And so you could write up some suggestions. And then me as a sociologist, I'm going to take this poll and publish it on Red Letter Christian's website so that we can see what the great wisdom of Greenbelt is to deal with precarity of the working class in Britain today. So I'd love you to stay in touch. I'd love to hear the stories from your communities about how Jesus and justice is looking where you live. Thank you very much for sharing this time and this tent with me today.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.